She would absolutely be willing to drop the August recess to help pass a fifth coronavirus relief bill.
This is a path to opening the economy and opening our schools. For some reason, the president has resisted that, but this is an absolute must.
The White House and Republican allies in Congress say the country needs time for earlier relief packages to work out, and that pushing for yet another massive package would be premature. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 11:04. I'm Hannah Haynes. The percentage of positive tests for the coronavirus remained high yesterday in Wisconsin. The state DHS reported more than 6,600 new tests yesterday. 7.5% of them came back positive. That's a decrease from the day before, when over 10% of the tests were positive. Though there was a slight decrease in the percent of positive tests yesterday, the 7-day average for new cases remains at an all-time high. There were no new deaths reported yesterday. The state's death toll sits at 820 people. As of this morning, the New York Times reports that Wisconsin is experiencing hot spots for the coronavirus in Superior, Fond du Lac, Marquette, and Sauk counties. The DHS lists the entire state as having a high activity level for the coronavirus, and 47 counties individually have been given that designation as well. Wearing a face covering to prevent the spread of the coronavirus will be mandatory in Milwaukee under an ordinance approved yesterday by the city council. The ordinance is more strict than the one that went into effect yesterday in Dane County. The Milwaukee mandate requires masks both indoors and outdoors. The Journal Sentinel reports the council also unanimously adopted a separate proposal to provide free masks to city residents. Anyone age 3 and older would have to wear a face covering in buildings open to the public, as well as any outdoor space when it's not possible to stay 6 feet away from people. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett said he will sign the ordinance. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru, with the 2020 Subaru Forester, featuring standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and safety technology. Love, it's what makes Subaru, Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.
Contributors to WPR include UW Health, an Al Johnson Swedish restaurant and boutique. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Details can be found at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Ganschert Nursery and Landscapes, with full-service landscape design and installation to Madison and surrounding communities since 1951, providing seasonal cleanup and pruning of trees and shrubs. Ganschert.com.
Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk with you about diabetes. 11% of the adult population in Wisconsin have diabetes, and over 36% have pre-diabetes. So pretty likely that you may have it yourself, or you may know someone, a loved one or a friend or family member who has diabetes or pre-diabetes. We'll talk about those scary statistics a bit with our guest, Dr. Dawn Davis. She is a UW Health endocrinologist, also an associate professor of medicine. She works out of the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So, Dr. Dawn Davis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
So, as you listen to Dr. Davis, I hope you'll join in. How has diabetes diagnosis affected your life, for example? Have current conditions made it hard for you to treat it? Love to hear from you. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Great to have you back, Dr. Davis. You know, I think last time you were with us, we did this question-answer to begin with. Then let's do it again and talk about what diabetes is and the difference between type 1 and type 2.
Sure. So type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes are kind of the major forms of diabetes that we see. There are a few others, but those are the most common. And basically, diabetes itself is a disease where the level of sugar or glucose in your blood is too high. And type 1 diabetes is what we used to refer to as juvenile diabetes. It is often diagnosed in children and young adults, and it is caused by an autoimmune process where the body essentially attacks the cells that make insulin, and then your body can no longer make insulin. And insulin is a hormone that you make that is really important for maintaining those blood sugar, blood glucose levels in your system. So every time you eat, your body absorbs some sugars and glucose from the food, and then you secrete some insulin, which comes out of these little cells called beta cells located inside your pancreas, in your abdomen, in your belly. And those beta cells make insulin, which then travels through your bloodstream and helps take that glucose out of your blood and moves it into your tissues where your body needs to use it for energy and to keep the blood glucose levels lower. So without insulin, the blood glucose gets higher and higher. Your other body tissues don't have enough energy, and it can make you very sick in a relatively short period of time. So people with type 1 diabetes, again, they don't make insulin on their own because their body has kind of attacked and destroyed all those cells that make insulin. So they need to take insulin every day, multiple times a day, every time they eat, in order to help maintain those blood sugar levels. And then type 2 diabetes is the most common form of diabetes. It's found in about 95% of the population who has diabetes has type 2 diabetes. And this form of diabetes is more associated with older adults and obesity. So the risk factors for type 2 diabetes include being overweight, having a sedentary lifestyle, family history of diabetes, and age. As you get older, your risk goes up of developing type 2 diabetes. And in this case, these patients sometimes still make insulin on their own, so they can lower their blood sugars a bit, but they're what we call insulin resistant, which means that their bodies don't use the insulin as well as they should, and therefore they can't lower their blood sugars normally, and they often need to take medications to help them use their insulin more effectively. And some of them also need to take insulin as well to keep their blood sugars under good control.
Ma'am. And what about pre-diabetes? What is considered pre-diabetes?
Right. So pre-diabetes, as you mentioned, affects about a third of the population of adults in this country. And what we consider pre-diabetes is essentially a mild increase in blood sugars that isn't yet to the point where it's going to cause long-term complications or problems, but it's an early warning sign that that person might be on the wrong track. And if you have prediabetes, you have a very high chance of developing diabetes in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's kind of, you started on this progression and unfortunately kind of rolling down the hill toward a diagnosis of diabetes. And so what we like to do is identify those people who have pre-diabetes, because we have a lot of opportunity to kind of push them back up the hill and prevent them from moving toward diabetes by increasing activity, a healthy diet, and a modest weight loss can make a big difference at that stage.
Yeah. You know, Joe in DeForest has something for us that I think relates to what you were just talking about. Joe, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I woke up the other day and my numbers were average for me in the morning, about 140. And within a half hour, they were down to 40. What makes that sudden drop? I've had that happen about 4 or 5 times in a total of 20 years.
Hmm. Well, so first of all, let me just tell others what those numbers mean a little bit. So a normal blood glucose level or blood sugar level is between about 70 and about 120 when you're first waking up in the morning. Even in a normal person, between 70 and 100 would be a normal blood sugar when you first wake up. Sometimes it'll go up a little higher after you eat, up to maybe 150 or so in patients who don't have diabetes. So somewhere in that range between 70 and 150 is a normal blood sugar. So what you're talking about there is that when you wake up, your blood sugar is a little bit higher than normal at around 140, and then it drops to 40, which is quite low blood sugar. And low blood sugars are a problem in patients who have diabetes as well, because while we are working to prevent those high blood sugars, unfortunately, sometimes the medications that we use can also cause low blood sugars. And so we can overshoot sometimes and end up with low blood sugars, which we call hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. So I guess I'm not entirely sure in your particular case what could be the cause of that. It might be related to some medications that you're taking. Some people also can have, pretty rapid changes in their blood sugars after they eat a meal, particularly a meal that has a lot of carbohydrates in it, because they have altered timing of their insulin secretion. So again, it's a little hard to know in your specific case, but I guess the point would be that it's really tough for patients who have diabetes, because there can be these pretty rapid shifts and changes in their blood sugars, and they can end up high or low, both of which can cause problems and consequences.
There you go, Joe. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too with your questions or comments at 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So talk about different treatments for diabetes. Are there many types of treatments out there?
Yeah, there really are. We've kind of had a revolution in some ways in terms of the options we have to treat diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, over the last 10 to 20 years. And we now have at least 10 different classes of medications we can use for type 2 diabetes. In type 2 diabetes, as I mentioned before, we can use medicines that help your body use insulin more effectively, that help your body get rid of extra sugar in your blood, that help your body make or use other hormones that regulate your insulin more effectively. So there's lots of different ways we can tackle the high blood sugars in type 2 diabetes. Unfortunately, in type 1 diabetes, as I mentioned earlier, that those patients have an absolute requirement for insulin, so they have to take insulin. Sometimes we combine that with some other treatments as well, but insulin is an absolute requirement for those who have type 1, and it usually is going to be multiple doses of insulin per day, at least, 4 to 5 injections of insulin per day for type 1 diabetes.
And you said injections, so it's still giving yourself an injection.
It is. We've also, though, advanced a lot in terms of technology for insulin delivery. And so while, yes, it is still some form of injection, we now have insulin pens, which are a little different than the old syringes and vials that we used to have to use. We can still use those as well. Insulin pens are still a little needle, but a little bit easier way to deliver the insulin. And then we even have something now called an insulin pump, which has been available for a few decades, but the technology keeps getting better and better. Insulin pumps continuously deliver insulin underneath the skin, so you don't have to stop and do a separate injection every time. You just kind of push a button on your pump and tell it how much insulin you need at any moment in time, and it adjusts it hour by hour, minute by minute for you.
Is that pump, what is it? Is it inserted in your body, or how does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's the only part that's in your body is a tiny little part attached to your skin. And so there's a little tiny piece of plastic, like a little IV catheter that goes under the skin, very small. And that's where the insulin is kind of trickling in. And then the rest of it's all external. And so you change that little area, we call it your injection site or your infusion site, every few days. And it connects through to a little device that holds the insulin. And that's about the size of an old pager or a very small old cell phone. And that device is what controls your insulin delivery. And nowadays, again, you can control a lot of this remotely with your cell phone, and you can adjust a lot of things you know, without even having to stop and do an injection or change things up. And then we now also have kind of the latest and greatest is what they call artificial pancreas technology, which combines those insulin pumps with continuous glucose monitors. And what those do is they also are a small little device that attaches to your skin and has a little electrode underneath the skin that measures your blood sugar every 5 minutes for you. So it can basically tell your pump how much insulin you need based on your blood sugar, and then it can fine tune and adjust your blood sugar for you in like an automatic way to help maintain it. So these are some really exciting new things that we have available now, which can really help. But unfortunately, it's a lot of technology, which often comes with a lot of expense and a lot of challenges sometimes for patients to be able to get access to that technology.
Yeah, I imagine that not every insurance policy would cover something like that.
Right, correct. Especially for those who have type 2 diabetes and might need insulin. Unfortunately, a lot of that technology is not covered as well as it should be or could be.
Dr. Dawn Davis, our guest today. Let's take another call from Connie in Portage next. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yep. Oh, good. Well, I was just diagnosed with diabetes. He said my blood sugar was 130, but he offered nothing because I'm an old RN and I'm sort of stubborn. And I said, well, I'll just lose weight. Forget about it. But I can't seem to be losing that. I'm 100 pounds overweight and I can't seem to be losing weight. So I'm wondering, should I go back to him and do I need a pill or something, or is that really dangerous, the 130?
Sure. That's a really good question, Connie. So, again, just to kind of remind everyone of the numbers here, I'm assuming you're talking about your blood sugar when you first woke up in the morning when you had nothing to eat. Is that right?
Well, I don't know because I went to the doctor and had a fasting blood sugar.
Yeah, right. Okay. So your fasting blood sugar, the normal range is, like I said, between about 70 and 100. We diagnose people with diabetes when that fasting blood sugar gets above 126. So yours is 130. So not too far above that diagnosis range. Pre-diabetes, we say between 100 and 125. So you're just in the diabetes side of that range. And so you're right. There's a couple things you can do. You can certainly, you know, make some efforts, but, you know, I want to certainly say to you, Connie, that you're not alone in the fact that it's really hard to make major life changes and to be able to lose weight. It's not an easy process and it takes a lot of time. I would certainly encourage you to keep working on that as best you can. But oftentimes we do need to start a medication to help maintain those blood sugars along the way while you're still working on trying to lose that weight, but to make sure that things stay in a safe range and we can prevent complications from developing down the road related to your diabetes. So yes, I would say if you've made your best effort on, you know, weight loss and lifestyle changes, then now's the time to probably go back and say, I think we need to add a medication. And at this point, it would probably just be a simple pill that you would take once a day, something like that.
There you go, Connie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Dawn Davis is a UW health endocrinologist, associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Our guest today, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at diabetes today and managing it with our guest, Dr. Dawn Davis from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, the chief of endocrinology at the William S. Middleton VA Hospital in Madison. So it's great to have her back with us. Certainly, again, if you have a question or comment, join in at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Has COVID-19 affected diabetes patients much? Do you see, are they more likely to get the disease?
That's a great question. we don't have any evidence yet that people who have diabetes are more likely to get COVID-19. The risk of getting the virus would be the same as anyone else. But we definitely see worse outcomes in patients who have COVID-19 and diabetes. So they're more likely to end up needing hospitalization or needing a ventilator or even dying from COVID-19. So once they get the disease, their risk is definitely higher. So we are strongly encouraging our patients who have diabetes to be extra careful and vigilant about, protecting themselves from exposure to COVID-19. And certainly also reaching out and getting medical attention if they do develop any symptoms so they can have an early diagnosis and careful monitoring and treatment if they need additional support. That creates a lot of challenges for people because they, as we mentioned earlier, there's a lot of people who have diabetes in this state and this country, and those people may have to go to work and they may have to care for their children and things where they can't always completely avoid exposure. So it is a challenging time for these patients, and it's also challenging economic times for a lot of people. And as we talked a little bit about, we have all this great technology, we have insulins, we have all these medications for diabetes, but they all can be very expensive. So the average medical cost for a patient who has diabetes is around $17,000 a year, which under normal times is incredibly expensive. And now people with, loss of health insurance and loss of jobs and other things can really be devastating. So it's very challenging. And, what we're also encouraging our patients with diabetes to, not defer and avoid medical care during this time. We know that people are kind of afraid to come into the medical system or maybe, trying to save money. But we also know that if they aren't able to care for their diabetes effectively or start holding medications or rationing medications, that it can get them into trouble in a big hurry. So our big message, I think, is that people should reach out and talk to their healthcare providers about whatever challenges they may be facing so that we can try to help them find the resources they need to still take good care of themselves.
Yeah, for sure. Those of us who get a chance to work from home are kind of lucky that way. We still have a job and we're still able to work from home. But not everybody, as you say, is exactly that fortunate. Yeah. Brock in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Brock.
Hello, Larry and Dr. Davis. Thanks so much for this important show. The question I have pertains to symptoms I've had increasing of late and being long-term pre-diabetic. So my A1C has been 6.1 to 6.3 probably for the last 6 or 7 years now. Hasn't gone up, hasn't gone down. And I have increasing numbness in my feet. And over the last month or so, I get cramps in both of my feet most every night, such that I have to get up 2 or 3 times, jump out of bed, walk around, to get the cramps to go away in my feet. And I'm wondering if those symptoms can be directly attributed to being pre-diabetic for a long time, or if perhaps they're more likely due to something else.
Sure. So that's a great question. Again, if you don't mind, Brock, I'm going to define a few of the things you said for the rest of the audience who may not be familiar with all these numbers. You mentioned your A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is a blood test that we use for patients who have diabetes or prediabetes, and it gives us an idea of their average blood sugar over the previous 3 months. And again, it's important to kind of know the cutoff for normal here. So that what you're describing with a hemoglobin A1C of 6.1 to 6.3% does fall in the diabetes range. In the pre-diabetes range, which is basically between about 5.8 and 6.5%. And then anything above 6.5% we consider in the diabetes range. So we use this number to monitor patients who have diabetes as well to see how well they're doing in terms of their overall blood sugar control. So you're right that overall it looks like your numbers are still in the pre-diabetes range, which is great. And the fact that you've been able to keep them there for 6 to 7 years is also a good sign. As we mentioned earlier, the risk of progressing to diabetes over 5 to 10 years is pretty high, but it sounds like you've been able to maintain a stable position there, which is great. In terms of your numbness and foot cramps, so my guess is that it's probably unrelated, but it certainly would be reasonable if you haven't already, recently had that, monitoring like your A1C check to make sure that things haven't progressed. Numbness in your feet is one of the things that we sometimes see in patients who have diabetes. It's called diabetic neuropathy, and it is one of the complications of longer-term diabetes. It can basically result in numbness, tingling, sometimes even painful sensations in the feet. So I think that's kind of what you're getting at and what you're concerned about. Foot cramps are a little different and not as typically related with diabetes per se. So I think what I would just recommend is probably, if you haven't already, check in with your doctor and make sure you've had some recent screening to be sure that your diabetes hasn't progressed. And then I would also get in for an examination so they can see if there's any evidence of that diabetic neuropathy on your foot exam. They can tell by just checking your sensation and some other things on an examination.
So get in and have them take a look, Brock. Thank you so much for calling. John in Port Wing, we move to you now. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I'm a 77-year-old type 2 diabetic. I'm medicated with oral and with insulin. And in the past few days, even up here, we've been getting lots of hot, humid weather. And I've had a heck of a time for the last week or so with my blood sugars going low. And I'm just curious, is that normal or can that happen because of the hot, humid weather? I've been working fairly strenuously outside.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so again, I'll certainly recommend that you talk to your physician or prescribing provider about these low blood sugars, because they may need to make some adjustments in your medications to help avoid those. So this gets us back again to what we were talking about, that, we have to worry both about high blood sugars and about low blood sugars with diabetes. So low blood sugars can be quite dangerous, and they when you have a low blood sugar, what happens is essentially your body doesn't have enough energy or fuel to provide energy to the brain and other parts of your body. And so you start to feel confused. Patients can even kind of lose consciousness, have seizures, and even more severe symptoms when they have a very low blood sugar. So we do have to be careful about avoiding those. And I think what you mentioned, John, is that you've been doing some more strenuous activity outdoors this time of year, and that is definitely something that could be contributing to these low blood sugars. Again, when you're doing that high energy activity, your body's using up a lot of your energy stores and your fuel, and it's burning up that glucose, basically. So in addition to having insulin on board that's helping lower your glucose, now your body is lowering it a bit on its own. So that combination can lead to low blood sugar. So I think it's very likely that your increased activity and exertion is part of the problem. And you may need to reduce your insulin doses or just be careful about the timing of your exercise and activity so that it's not dropping your blood sugars as much in relationship to the timing of your insulin doses.
That makes good sense. John, thank you so much. Christy in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Christy.
Good morning, and thank you for your wonderful service. I just was talking to my sister-in-law, who's a retired nurse in California, in Oregon, and there's a study they're doing on diabetes in relation to early childhood trauma. And I wondered if you had read any of those studies or you know about any of that.
Interesting.
Yeah, Christy. Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not necessarily familiar with that particular study, but there is a lot of interesting work about, you know, all kinds of things that might happen early in life that can predispose you to developing both obesity and diabetes later in life. Things related to your birth weight, to eating patterns as a very young child, and then what you're mentioning, early childhood trauma or life stressors. And honestly, that's not just in childhood, unfortunately, but throughout life, we know that, you know, people who are under increased levels of chronic stress are at higher risk of obesity and diabetes. And part of the reason is that one of the things your body does when you're under stress is it makes a hormone called cortisol. Cortisol is like your body's stress hormone, basically. And cortisol, unfortunately, kind of acts against insulin. It raises blood sugars and it can make your body more resistant to insulin. So when you have higher levels of cortisol from chronic stress, that can certainly increase your risk of developing these problems. And this is part of why we do see increased rates of diabetes and, you know, people in certain populations, particularly probably it has a big part of why we see it in lower socioeconomic groups and, others that are under kind of chronic stressors and have these, challenges in their daily lives that make it hard to manage their stress, and it can over time lead to obesity and diabetes.
Yeah, and I don't imagine the COVID-19 has also
has
all of us stressed. Mm-hmm. But it adds to those who are under a lot of stress to begin with, and have that on top of it has got to be tough for sure. Christy, thank you so much. Bill in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Interesting show, I should say. Diabetes type 1, by the way, and that's important to really emphasize that, for 43 years. And I'm one of the fortunate ones, a few small microaneurysms in the eye, but I was the first person in Wisconsin to ever use an insulin pump. That was 1980. And was one basal rate that was adjusted with a screwdriver, had a transistor battery in it. The needles were over 3/4 inch. I'd bend them at a 45 to put them under the skin, steel needles, of course. And wow. So pretty amazing all the way around. So, and that was at the UW Hospital here with Dr. Michael McDonald. I wanted to emphasize hypoglycemia unawareness, because I was going as low as 20 with no symptoms, period, because I had pushed, and so my A1C were pushing it a little higher because I had a traumatic brain injury because I went down with a seizure down into the sidewalk. So I think it's real important. My A1C, we push it up a little bit because of that concern. I just wanted to emphasize the importance of people understanding hypoglycemia unawareness as well. So I had a heck of a lot of experiences.
Sounds like it, Bill. Thanks
sounds
for calling.
Like
oh, well,
thank
have you?
Yeah, have you, that's really. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, have you ever encountered anybody like Bill who's had that many years of experience with it?
Yeah, I have, you know, part of being a specialist at the university hospital is we end up taking care of, you know, a fair amount of patients that, who are like this, who have had, you know, more complicated diabetes for a long time. And I really appreciate you sharing those stories, Bill, because it's always, you know, fun to hear about, you know, honestly, not fun for you, but the challenges that you faced with, you know, diabetes care in the early days. You know, we didn't have all these things we have now, and, you know, patients had to have these complicated chemical reactions in their, you know, house to measure their blood sugars, and they had these big, huge needles to deliver insulin, and the insulins we had were not as easy to work with, and so we've really come a long way, and because we've come a long way, it's really helped, you know, our patients like Bill be able to survive and thrive with type 1 diabetes for many, many decades. So it's really great to hear that. And he also brings up a really important point about hypoglycemia unawareness. So again, we talked about how low blood sugars can be quite dangerous, and sounds like he had a bad episode there where he had a seizure. Unfortunately, what happens sometimes is when patients have low blood sugars over and over again throughout their life, they lose the ability to notice them. So normally, if you have a low blood sugar, your body's going to feel it right away. You get shaky, you get sweaty, you might feel hungry, you might get a little bit, confused or irritable, but you know it, and then you're able to eat something and fix your low blood sugar pretty quickly. But unfortunately, when that happens over and over again, your body starts to kind of get numb to it or get used to it, and then you don't notice those symptoms anymore until your blood sugar is very dangerously low. And then, unfortunately, that's when people can really get into trouble with seizures and car accidents and other major problems from low blood sugar. So we have to be really vigilant about that. And sometimes it's much safer for those patients to run their blood sugars just a little bit higher. The risks of that are much lower than severe low blood sugars.
Yeah. Bill, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. Michael in Waukegan, Illinois, your turn. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I listened to the lady talk about her fasting blood sugars being over 130. And my fasting blood sugars are usually 125 to 135. And you recommended the lady might need medication. But my doctors really don't feel that's needed. My A1Cs are usually 5.4 to 5.6. And the explanation is something about the glycogen in the liver is released at night, and that's why my sugars are high in the morning. But no medications have been prescribed. They just say, you're doing fine.
Well, what do you think, Dr. Davis?
Right. So, I think if your hemoglobin A1C level is in that 5.4 to 5.6 range, that is reassuring that you may be doing well. However, I would say that it might be important to check your blood sugars at some other times of day. The hemoglobin A1C test is good, but it's not a perfect test. In other words, it's a way we can estimate an average blood sugar, but there are some patients where it's not accurate. So that is an important thing to be aware of. It's not always going to be exactly correct. So if your fasting blood sugars are in that 125 to 135 range, then I would suggest that you maybe check some at other times of day to see if they're also high. And you're right. One of the hallmarks of type 2 diabetes is that higher blood sugar in the morning. And sometimes you might have normal blood sugars the rest of the day. So you're overall doing pretty well. But a medication might still be helpful because it could help lower those fasting blood sugars back into the normal range. And what we most commonly use as the first step here is a medicine called metformin, which is a pill that you take, and it helps essentially lower that fasting blood sugar by targeting the liver, like you mentioned, and the glycogen breakdown in the liver. And basically, it shuts down that release of sugar from your liver, which is an important normal process to keep your blood sugars from dropping too low when you're not eating. But unfortunately, in diabetes, that gets a little out of whack and you start kicking out more sugar than you should. So metformin could be a good option for you. Again, I'm not sure it's absolutely necessary, but I would maybe investigate that a little further with your providers.
There you go, Michael. Thank you so much. Saul in Stevens Point, we're on to you now. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's just an explanation of why type 2 diabetes is so prevalent in the Western world. That is, we've only got one hormone that's involved in storing excess energy supplies, including proteins. And we've got a number of things like adrenaline and cortisol that handle starvation. And the usual state of animals in the world is starvation. It's not three meals a day or four or five and snacks. And really, we're suffering from the bounty of our food system. We have a lot of cheap available food for people, and it's just not something that the rest of the animal world is exposed to.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Dr. Davis?
No, you're absolutely right, Paul. What he mentioned is correct, that, we really primarily have one hormone that helps us, lower sugar and move energy into your tissues. And we have a lot of hormones that do the opposite. And that was, you know, evolutionarily probably important to allow us to maintain normal blood sugars when you didn't have food, to maintain energy stores when you don't have food availability. But nowadays that, you know, even in areas where people don't necessarily have the best access to food, they unfortunately are often eating foods that are not healthy and are not contributing to their overall well-being. So they have to, you know, essentially eat poor food choices in many cases that contribute further to this. So you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, it's no longer just a problem in the Western world. As, you know, food availability becomes more and more, food becomes more and more accessible, and kind of these lower quality foods become more accessible throughout the world, diabetes has really exploded worldwide as well.
Mm. Saul, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today is Dr. Dawn Davis, a UW Health endocrinologist, associate professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also chief of endocrinology at the William S. Middleton VA Hospital in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Right here on the Ideas Network.